From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we go to Nicaragua, the scene of an election this past weekend, showing a resounding victory for the Sandinista Front. President Daniel Ortega reelected so far with about 75% of the vote, with about half of the vote total being counted as of 12:20 p.m. Eastern time on Monday. No surprises there. And although at the end of the term in 2027, he'll have been in power for how long? When did he first take office?
Well, 20 years. He took office in January 2007.
Okay, so then after a 20-year term, the American press, for some reason, I guess they forgot about Pinochet and a whole host of characters in Latin America over the years, is referring to him as the longest-serving head of state in Latin America, with a very strong painting of the situation as being essentially, you know, king-made, dictatorial, anti-democratic system. They actually used the words from here and there in the U.S. media, pretty much from top to bottom. Stephen is part of a group. He lives and has been, of course, as you know, in Nicaragua for 20-some-odd years in the last jog, right? 30 years maybe, right?
Yeah, 25 years now.
Yeah.
28 years.
Yes, almost 30 years. And he has been hosting and or assisting a group of international observers going down to look at the elections, including journalists from the United States and elsewhere. And we're going to talk about the election. Stephen, first of all, glad to have you with us as usual. So what have you seen over the past few days?
Well, it's been a very uplifting and encouraging and inspiring experience, Don, because here in Nicaragua, we have a people that have a genuinely democratic system, unlike the people of the United States, with a far superior election security to the election security that is available to the people of the United States. And we've had a group of almost 250 people who are accompanied. Sorry about all the noises. There's lots of people trying to get in touch.
Good.
So we've had about 250 people from a total of 29 countries visiting Nicaragua during this period. About 45, 46 maybe of those are international reporters and writers of one kind or another from different media. And around 200 or so are people that the government here is calling people who are here to accompany the elections and have accompanied the elections. And the reason they use that terminology is because they want to get away from the neo-colonial term election observer, which is what the European Union and the Organization of American States and so on aspire to impose on countries that are holding elections. And what does that mean? What that means is that the European Union and the Organization of American States think that an election can't be free and fair if it's not overseen by people from white Europe and the white United States and Canada, essentially. That's what it essentially means.
Right.
And so, and here in Nicaragua, the authorities here reject that completely. They have their own system of national observation, and in terms of actually ensuring that the vote is free and fair, what we had here in Nicaragua was a country with a small population of something between 6.5 and 7 million people now, and of that, on the electoral roll, there are something like 4,100,000, something like that.
Right.
And the way they run their system here is that at every in every voting station, there are I think there are a total of 3,100 voting stations around the country to serve the population.
Right.
And within those voting centres or voting stations, there are maybe anything between 6 to 12 actual polling stations.
Right.
So there are something like, within those 3,100 voting centres, there are something like 13,000 or so, a bit more, what one might describe as polling stations.
Right.
And that means that if you, obviously, if you divide 4.1 million or whatever the electoral right. roll is by that number of voting stations, you come up with a figure of something like 300 or so
right.
Voters to each polling station,
which
something like
good.
That.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So you can see that it allows people ready access to wherever they have to vote. And here there's a system whereby people who change their address are encouraged to contact the electoral roll, the electoral authority themselves, inform the electoral authority of that change of address, so that even though the change of address is different from the address that's on their identity card, which is in a national database here, right. they can vote where they happen to be living right now. And that dramatically increases the access of voters to be able to exercise their right to vote.
Right.
So, and in terms of the security of the vote at each polling station, who are the people that staff those polling stations? They're people that are proposed by all the political parties that are taking part in the election. So every political party that's participating in the election puts forward their representatives and proposes those representatives to the electoral authority, that then tries to make sure that at every polling station there's a representative of each political party in each polling station. That's all not always possible,
right.
Because some of the smaller parties can't manage to
they don't have that many
provide
people. Right.
the right number of people.
Right.
But what that means is that in any given polling station, the people that receive the ballot papers and count them, so at the opening of the polling station, and the people that tally the votes at the end of the voting session, at the end of the day of the vote, all come from the different political parties participating
right.
in the election.
Right.
And that is an exceptionally strong control on to prevent electoral fraud
right.
because obviously the members of each political party are going to make sure that they get the votes that were genuinely cast for their political party.
Right.
So that in itself renders this idea that it's necessary to have foreign observers from Europe and North America to ensure the security of the vote, it just renders that whole idea absurd.
Right.
So then, in addition to that, what happens in the voting process is that people are on a database. And those lists, the voting lists for each voting centre, are posted outside each polling station, so that people can come, make sure that they're on the list. If there's a change, what they've done this year in these elections was ensure that there's a computing centre that's connected to the national database. And if anybody had difficulty and went to the wrong place to vote, they could go to the computing centre, check where they were actually supposed to vote. And what we actually saw that the people in the voting centres that we went to, we visited four voting centres in the town of Chinandega, mm-hmm. in the northwest of Nicaragua, and we saw people. There was a tremendous help for people with disability, for older people who had difficulty making their way on their own. They got tremendous support from the staff in each voting centre, and people who had to go to another voting centre, if they were young enough, they were taken on a motorbike to where they were supposed to vote. And if they were not able enough to be taken on a motorbike, they were taken by vehicle to the place where they were supposed to vote. And can you imagine that happening in the United States?
That's pretty good. I mean, you have people, the political parties will have volunteers that take folks to the polls, but what they do is they call their own, they pull the list, they call their own voters and say, you know, the Democrats call Democratic voters and say, do you want to ride to the polls? And the Republicans call Republican voters and they say, do you want to ride to the polls? Like that. There's no state support for that kind of thing. That's the point.
Right. Yeah, so here in Nicaragua, that's the way the system worked. There are all kinds of checks and controls. In addition to that inherent control within the voting system itself of all the political parties taking part in the supervision of the actual casting of the votes, you have a system of national observation whereby thousands of students and teaching staff from the country's universities take part. This happens in every election process here in Nicaragua. And those students obviously come from all political shades of opinion. As well as that, in the inherent control by the individual members of the political parties actually supervising the casting of votes in polling stations, you have a broad-based group of highly literate, well-educated students and teachers from the country's university system also supervising and making sure that the procedures. The regulations are followed in each voting station and in each polling station.
Right.
So in terms of observation, I mean, when people say that there's no observation, what they mean is that there's no neo-colonial foreign presence there to say whether the United States or its European allies are prepared to accept the election or not.
Well,
and that's what that means.
Yeah, well, that doesn't matter, apparently, because they're opining anyway. The title of the most recent piece at the U.S. Department of State website at state.gov under Nicaragua's Undemocratic Election is the name of the press statement dated November 8th. It says that President Ortega and Vice President Murillo have declared themselves the winner of national elections, whose outcome has long been a foregone conclusion. Now, what they leave out is the reason there was a foregone conclusion is that they've been reelected, Ortega has been reelected now with 70% or better of the popular vote. What, three times in a
74.
Row now? Yeah, right. Okay. 74% of the vote, okay. What, three times now? This is the third time?
Yeah, and when he first went in 2006, he just squeaked in because the opposition was divided.
Right, so then in 2012?
In 2011, I think it was around 60% of the votes.
Okay, then?
61. And then in 2016, he won with a slightly increased majority, something like 64-65%. And now, because of the incredibly successful social and economic policies that he's implemented on behalf of the Nicaraguan people, meeting their needs as human persons, he has been elected with 74% of the vote.
Yep. So, it's
really surprising, actually. Even people that are quite radical, Don, who've come to and are in the group of reporters here, They didn't realize that there were even any opposition candidates running.
Right.
And because all they get is the gross, idiotic propaganda that is put out by the New York Times, the BBC, CNN, name any major Western media outlet.
Not just the Western media outlets, even the so-called defenders of freedom of the press organizations, the 501c3s, like the Committee to Protect Journalists. They're more aggressive in the propaganda, to call it that, is being gentle.
I mean, the Committee to Protect Journalists, right? So in 2018, the violent opposition protests there burned down a radio station, a Sandinista radio station.
Right.
They burned it down with 22 of the workers in that radio inside the building, and they tried to prevent the workers leaving the building. So they were deliberately set out to burn those radio station workers to death just because they were Sandinistas.
Right.
What was the response of the Committee of Public Journalists? Oh, the states, the government must do more to protect journalists.
Right.
But please let me finish this. Then the committee to this committee to protect journalists, they gave an award to the opposition journalists who instigated that attack on their Sandinista journalist colleagues. That is what the U.S. Committee for the Protection of Journalists is.
Amazing.
I know, there's chapter and verse out there on the web. I can send you the links if you want. People, it's disgusting.
There's some cute stuff. Meanwhile, if you look at who these people actually are, first of all, the Committee to Protect Journalists may sound like a ragtag volunteer organization of dedicated journalists like, I would say, Julian Assange and Gary Webb. And you know, of course, that the West highly values those kinds of journalists. For some reason, their bank balance at the close of 2019, which was the last year that the tax returns from this entity, this 501c3 corporation in the United States based in New York, made public, they had somewhere in the neighborhood of $28 million on hand.
Yeah.
And if you look at their
please
program,
let's not waste time talking about the corporate shells. And
that's what we're talking about. So, okay, so go ahead. So tell us more about, you know, about the election and about basically what's been happening in the country that would produce a result like this. You know,
here in the election, there are two big lies, really, about the election, that there are no opposition candidates. Well, of course, there were five national opposition parties and one very important opposition party of indigenous peoples that was running candidates, not for the presidential election, but in the very important legislative elections.
Right.
And that party called Yatamo was running candidates in both the northern and southern autonomous regions of Nicaragua's Caribbean coast. So, in fact, there were six opposition parties running against the ruling Sandinista Front political parties alliance. So people need to understand that there was a wide choice available to people that wanted to vote in favor of the opposition parties. The second big lie is that opposition presidential candidates were arrested before the election, and therefore they were the election couldn't have been free and fair because these opposition candidates were arrested for political reasons.
Right.
Well, in fact, not one of the people that was detained was anywhere close to being a presidential candidate in these elections. They weren't even members of registered political parties.
Right.
And all of them had engaged in activities which would have disqualified them under the rules applied by Nicaragua's electoral law. Because one of the provisions of Nicaragua's electoral law is that people who have tried to call for sanctions against Nicaragua, essentially committing treason, are not allowed to stand as presidential candidates.
Right.
And so all the people that were arrested were people who'd engaged in that kind of behavior, but also in very serious organized crime activities like money laundering and so on, mostly related to financial malfeasance.
Right.
And let me just give you an idea of that. The U.S. Embassy candidate who the U.S. Embassy were hoping they'd be able to impose on Nicaragua's political system, who wasn't even a member of a political party. They hoped they'd be able to do something like they did in 1990 with Violeta Barrios de Chamorro, whom they imposed on the the Nicaragua's opposition parties back then, and basically they just bought off the opposition, the political oppositions, to stop them bickering amongst each other.
Right.
And so they tried to do the same in early 2021 with Violeta Chamorro's daughter, Cristiana Chamorro. Now, Cristiana Chamorro was elected, I think, was arrested very early in June. Why? Because she couldn't explain what had happened to $7 million that was being managed by her foundation, the foundation named after her mother, the Violeta Barrios de Chamorro Foundation.
Right.
And when she was asked, every year her foundation is supposed to present accounts and explain where the money came from and what it was spent on, which is just basic, isn't it? But when she was asked to explain herself by the Nicaraguan authorities, she couldn't. And in a press conference, when she was asked about that particular point, she was brazen enough to say, well, USAID went over our figures and they thought they were all right. And can you imagine the absurdity of that?
We let the CIA go through our books. They gave us a clean bill of health.
Exactly.
$7
million, Don.
So could you imagine, I have a foundation here, and it's a, you know, something having to do with the reconciliation and democracy like hers. I get some funding from, say, the FSB in Russia. And now I'm going to run for president. Can you imagine how that would play, say, in the Washington
and
Post?
It is totally absurd. And, of course, one of the reasons why Western mainstream media are so gross and outrageous in the lies that they print about Nicaragua or Venezuela or Cuba or Bolivia or any of the countries in Latin America run by progressive governments, one of the reasons that they're so gross is that they have to maintain people in North America in a state of idiocy as regards foreign policy.
There's a lot of like real solid raw material in that area here if you look around. But go ahead.
Right. So why was Cristiana Chamorro elected? Was she arrested? Was she arrested because she was a presidential candidate? No, she hadn't even been accepted as a pre-candidate by any political party.
Right.
Why was she arrested? She was arrested because she couldn't explain, for various reasons. But one of the most important reasons she was arrested is because she couldn't explain what happened to $7 million her foundation had in its account, and she couldn't account for it.
Right.
And so, you know, and the same is true in the case of the other people that were arrested. And there are various, in Nicaragua's criminal code, there are various criminal offenses to do with financial malfeasance and fraud. And most of the people that were arrested on charges related to financial malfeasance. Why is that? Because all these people were funded by either directly by USAID or by some other branch of the U.S. government.
Well,
like the National Endowment for Democracy.
Right.
No way. What essentially the Nicaraguan authorities were engaging with was a very sophisticated network of organized crime that used the kind of system that I think Michael Hudson and others have described as a veil of tears.
Yeah.
A veil of so that there are layers at layers and layers and layers of financial mechanisms and intermediaries that make it very difficult to identify who is the ultimate intellectual author of the fraud.
Right.
And that, so that's what that series of arrests was mostly about. It was also about, in some cases, it was also about people who'd broken their amnesty agreement. A lot of people were engaged in the extreme violence that I mentioned in the case of the radio station that was burnt down by the buddies of the Committee for the Protection of Journalists here. That kind of violence led to the arrest back in 2018 of quite a number of people who were engaged in that violence, but they benefited from an amnesty in 2019. Right. One of the terms of the amnesty was no reoffending. And what the Nicaraguan authorities found out was that these people are engaged in a plan also funded by USAID called Responsive Assistance in Nicaragua. And the basis of that plan was to organize the conditions and circumstances for a transitional government in Nicaragua around these elections. So what did that mean? What that meant was that these people were breaking the terms of their amnesty because they were planning to destabilize the elections that have just taken place yesterday.
Yeah.
So, and those two big lies, there are no opposition parties and the opposition presidential candidates have been arrested. Those have been the basis of much of the propaganda against Sandinistas, the Nicaragua's electoral system, and against the Sandinista government. And of course, this is like, you know how they talk about Assad did this or Gaddafi did
right,
that.
Yeah, right, yeah,
they,
yeah.
They per- so
Ortega.
The institutional reality here that there are four separate powers of state and one of them is the Supreme Electoral Council, and it's the Supreme Electoral right. Council that sets the rules right. and supervises the elections, and Daniel Ortega he's in the executive power. So he, right. although obviously he has a lot of influence, a lot of political influence.
He's the president. Yeah.
The actual functioning of the electoral system is entirely under the control of the Supreme Electoral Council.
Right. You know, on these issues of money laundering and incitement and such to violence, let's have just a moment to remember the historical link to the last time these characters in Washington tried to take power away from the Sandinistas, who were placed there by the people, that time by the people through revolutionary action led by the Sandinistas. And what they did, in essence, was sell cocaine to poor people in the United States and take that money and to buy weapons for Iran and to fund the Contras. The Contras were right. a group of right-wing death squads that were organized by the United States that were committing terrorist acts and war upon Nicaragua in order to change the regime last time. These are the same players this time. The daughter of the woman that ended up in the presidency at the negotiated end of the U.S. war on Nicaragua last time, with the same games, with money laundering and, you know, all kinds yeah. of sneaky deals.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that among the reporters that are down here and journalists that are down here are a team from Black Agenda Report and related right. other organizations, the Black Alliance for Peace, among others. I can't remember all the names of the organizations.
Yeah, I think Ajamu's there.
Tired at this point. But they're one of the writers down here. There's Margaret, Kimberly yeah. from Black Agenda Report, and a really excellent guy called Netfa Freeman, who's very
yeah,
good on just the
yeah.
issue that you've just been pointing right. to, the way that the U.S. authorities and the CIA in fomented drug use among vulnerable Afro-American youth, African Afro-descendant youth in the United States, so to achieve a double objective, to achieve levels of domestic control in the United States, but also to fund their aggression against the legitimate government here in Nicaragua via that group that you mentioned, the Contra.
And we got to stop here because we're out of time.
Right.
I just want to wrap that up by saying, and by the way, the journalist that broke that story in the United States was murdered first ostracized by the corporate media here. And I did not see the Committee to Protect Journalists or any of these other groups, Amnesty, etc., go to his defense or demand an investigation. So much for that. We will do a follow-up. I'm sure this is not going to be over next week when we speak, and we'll see what's happened in the interim. And thank you for your time again, Stephen.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.